drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Towards the end of the Second World War, Allied forces conducted a massive firebombing campaign on Japanese cities. It's estimated that in Tokyo, 100,000 people died during the bombings and more than a million were made homeless. A new documentary, Paper City, follows a group of survivors as they fight to keep the memory of those events alive and to gain recognition from the Japanese government. Adrian Francis is the director and also my guest on Radio National Drive and The Drawing Room. Welcome.
Hello, Patricia. Thank you.
So take us a little deeper into the history here. What happened in Tokyo on March 9 and 10th of 1945?
Well, at that time, the U.S. Army Air Forces, which is now known as the U.S. Air Force, they were holding three islands in the Pacific, which they could reach Tokyo from with their B-29 bombers. So just after midnight on March 10th, 1945, 334 B-29s, laden with thousands of tons, I think 1,500 tons of incendiary bombs, approached Tokyo. And, of course, being just after midnight, everybody was at home asleep. And at 7 minutes past midnight, they opened the bomber doors and dropped their payload on the sleeping civilians below. And, as you said in your introduction, about a quarter of the city was destroyed. I think it's about 40 square kilometers, and about 100,000 people were killed, although it's hard to say exactly how many.
One of your subjects says that people today would probably say that we were lying. They wouldn't believe it. How present is the memory of these events in Tokyo?
Yeah, it's a complicated question to answer. I think in terms of general awareness of the firebombings today, I think it's fairly low. So everybody learns that it happened at school, but I think it's not much more than, you know, on this day in 1945, this happened. So often when I was researching and shooting the film, I'd talk to people in either Japanese or English, acquaintances, friends and whatnot. And a lot of people, when I said I was making a film about the firebombing of Tokyo, a lot of people just heard the word bomb and said, oh, Hiroshima, or oh, Nagasaki. So it didn't really even occur to them, even though I was literally saying the word Tokyo, that's what I was talking about. But the bombings were concentrated on the east side of the city, which historically is a working class district. And on that side of town, and which is where I shot the documentary, there are still survivors alive. And I think oral history is really strong on the east side of Tokyo. So survivors have passed these stories down to their children and their grandchildren. And so that legacy within families is fairly strong on the east side. In the city as a whole, I'd say that there's not much awareness about it at all.
How did this become the story you wanted to tell then? You're not Japanese. This isn't your story per se. So why did it become so important to you?
I think when I was growing up in Australia, certainly going to public school, I didn't learn that much about the war apart from, you know, Allied victories and, you know, atrocities committed by the Japanese Imperial Army. Probably the only thing I knew about the Japanese civilian experience was the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I was already living in Tokyo. I'd been living in Tokyo for probably 5 years when I saw the Errol Morris documentary Fog of War, which touches on the firebombing of the 66 Japanese cities, beginning with Tokyo. And that's when really I started to, well, it was quite a shocking thing for me at the time, because to hear about, you know, a quarter of the city being destroyed, 100,000 people being killed, and then looking around at Tokyo and experiencing living in Tokyo where this story is just not a big part of the identity of the city, unlike in Hiroshima or Nagasaki where, you know, there is a peace museum and the A-bomb memorial. So the city's, you know, consciously think about these bombings as part of their identity, as part of their story. So I think what got me interested right at the beginning was why there was such a kind of gap in Tokyo between, you know, the horrific thing that had happened and why it didn't seem to be more prominent in the city's identity. And so I started to, you know, dig a little bit deeper and I started to reach out to survivors groups and so on.
You open the film with a song called There'll Be a Little Smokyo in Tokyo. This shows the gap between Western perception of the bombing versus the Japanese experience, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so. So it was interesting to find this archive, this song from the 1940s. And for anybody that sees the film, it gives you a very strong sense of the tone at the time in terms of how allies, including America and Australia, talked about and thought about Japan and Japanese. And that song, Smokyo in Tokyo, is kind of a celebration of, you know, impending revenge that the US was going to wreak on Tokyo and on other Japanese cities. But you get no sense from the lyrics of the song that there are people on the ground. It talks about Japan as a, how can I put it? Well, it leaves the human element out of the bombings, so you don't have to think about it.
On RN, this is The Drawing Room, and joining me in The Drawing Room is Adrian Francis, who's my guest, and we're talking about his new documentary, Paper City. So introduce us to the people in your documentary, because this movie is about them as much as about the history, but who are they?
My film features three elderly survivors, and at the time I met them, they were all in their mid to late 80s or early 90s, and they've all somehow been involved in, you know, campaigns to get the Japanese government to recognize what happened to them and to provide some kind of, I guess, compensation for everything they lost, as well as to build a peace museum and a memorial to leave behind a physical reminder of what happened. And so Mrs. Kiyoka, Michiko Kiyoka, is one of the survivors we feature in the film. And at the time she was 21 years old and she was living with her parents and her older sister in Asakusa. And for those of your listeners who are familiar with Tokyo or have visited Tokyo, you've probably been to Asakusa near Skytree, the Skytree Tower, near Sensoji Temple. So it's a very, you know, densely populated part of the city, and it certainly was at that time too. So Mrs. Kiyoka woke up with her family members, and at the time her dad was in charge of civilian fire drills. So civilians were told by the government and by government propaganda that they had to, they weren't allowed to flee if the city was bombed, but instead they had to stay and defend their houses and their homes. So he was in charge of fire drills, but the moment they stepped out of their house, they could see it was already beyond being able to do anything, that they just had to run for their lives. So the four family members, ran down to the Sumida River, and there was a northwesterly wind blowing that day, so it was blowing the flames towards the Sumida River, and at one point they realized that they had no choice but to get into the water itself. This was March, early March in Tokyo. So this is right at the beginning of spring. So I can't imagine how cold the water was, but that was the only way they knew how to survive. So she survived. Some of her family members didn't. And then Mr. Hiroshi Hoshino, who at the time I met was 84 years old. And he was kind of the leader of a group called the Society of Bereaved Family Members, or the Association of Bereaved Family Members. And they're a kind of memory activist group who've been involved in civilian issues and supporting the civilian victims of the firebombings for the last few decades through various campaigns. On the night of the firebombing, Mr. Hoshino was 14 years old, living with his mother and sister. And they, I guess, miraculously survived. They, for some reason, I think he can't even explain it, for some reason he ran in the opposite direction to the direction all his neighbors were running in, and they managed to survive. I think for him, the most harrowing thing about the firebombing of Tokyo was, you know, the next day, the next few days, walking through the city as a 14-year-old boy, and you could just see kind of clean across blocks, like across whole neighborhoods where there had been houses, but now there were nothing. Now there was nothing. And, you know, the streets were piled with corpses that still had not been cleaned away. So I think that made a huge impression on him, and why he later became active in the civilian movement.
And Adrian, what do these survivors want from their government? What are they campaigning for?
I think what they're campaigning for is really to leave behind an imprint, I think, on public memory. So over the decades, they've chosen various means to do this. At one point, they launched a class action against the Japanese government. They've also done many demonstrations, organized petitions, given testimonials in public. But through all these means they're using, they really want to leave an imprint on public memory. And what I mean by that is that essentially they know that their cities would never have been bombed if their own government had surrendered earlier than it did. So by the middle of 1944, about 9 months before the firebombing of Tokyo, it seems clear that the Japanese government knew that they couldn't win the war. And there were 7 months of bombing of Japanese cities, ending with the atomic bombs. And the survivors, I think, feel they know that in a way their own government bears some responsibility for what happened, for leading them down the track of war to begin with. But the other part is that since the war, in all these ways that they've been campaigning, the government's really done nothing at all for them. So there's been no compensation for civilian victims, even though, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were left homeless. They lost family members. They lost their livelihoods. But at the end of the war, they were essentially told by the government, well, now it's time to rebuild your lives. There's never been any assistance at all for them. At the same time, military families and soldiers received very generous pensions and, you know, really trillions of dollars up to now of yen in support. So they see a great double standard in how the military families and the civilian families have been treated. But I think most of all, really what they just want is for their stories to be remembered, so that we can learn from the past and this thing will never happen again. So I think it's really about holding their own government accountable and making sure that these things are never forgotten.
One of your subjects says that this was a savage attack, but I can't say that too self-righteously because this was a war that Japan waged. It seems like they blame the Japanese government for what happened more than perhaps the Americans. Is that a controversial perspective to point the finger at Japan?
Yes. yeah, I think it is. It depends where you sit on this, but where you stand on this, but essentially, there's still a lot of kind of unresolved issues around war memory in Japan, I think. For a lot of people, they just wanted to forget about the war, forget about the hardships of wartime and rebuild their lives. And I think part of it also is not wanting to look back on what Japan itself did. So there is a way in which younger Japanese people are very aware of the bombings, the atomic bombings, which, as we know, are unique. No other place has been had atomic bombs dropped on it. So there's a space to talk about the unique suffering of Japanese people in the war in terms of the atomic bombs. But I think there's less, certainly on the government's point of view, there's less desire to talk about conventional bombings or incendiary bombings, because just Japan itself launched hundreds of attacks on China during the war. We know, of course, the north coast of Australia was bombed, Darwin and so on. So I think if you talk about conventional bomb raids and the convention and the bombing of civilians, then that would open a really difficult conversation, I think, for the Japanese authorities. So it's easier to not talk about it, I think. There's also the relationship and the security agreement with the US. So it certainly doesn't benefit the Japanese government to bring up these prickly issues with the US itself.
You began making this film around the 70th anniversary of the bombing. That's some years ago now. What's the process of making a film like this? How do you keep that focus for so many years?
That's a good question. I think, well, certainly once you've done a certain amount of work on a film, I think you become completely invested in it. And certainly in an independent documentary like this, where myself and my producer, Melanie Brunt, who is based in Melbourne, we kind of sustained this this project ourselves for that long. So that in a way, you've got no choice to continue. It takes on a life of its own. I think personally, around the start of the project, or about a decade ago, my father died, and I was thinking a lot about legacy and leaving things behind, about what I was doing with my life. And so I think for me personally, that sense of really wanting to leave a mark or to do something substantial in the way other people might start a family or build a house or something, I think that was very important for me. But the other thing is the relationship with the survivors themselves. So I had wondered before I started to meet survivors whether they, the reason that we didn't know more about the firebombing is that the survivors themselves were perhaps reluctant to talk or wanted to forget what had happened. And when I began to meet them, particularly the three in my film, but certainly the many survivors around them that I also met, were very, very open and really their kind of life's work, in a way, is to leave behind something of this memory. So they were incredibly open with me, and I guess they knew that perhaps I might take their story to places that they couldn't themselves. For example, a documentary that gets seen in other countries. So I guess wanting to help them and help them to carry on the story was a big motivation for me because they trusted me to do that.
Adrian, congratulations and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Adrian Francis has been my guest in the drawing room and his movie Paper City is screening as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. Check online for details.